Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. Dr. Rakshanda Raman from the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center discussed a variety of topics pertaining to the breast cancer space, including the importance of early screening to match patients with appropriate therapies. Other subjects included her treatment strategies involving genomic profiling and cryoablation, her thoughts on using artificial intelligence in the clinic, and improving access to treatment among rural populations.
How might early breast cancer screenings and detections give patients more treatment options?
Well, so first off, the whole point of screening is to detect cancers at a very early stage. So we do know that the curability rate is much higher for a screen-detected cancer, you know, north of 95% versus a symptomatic patient. So right off the bat, their options towards cure are much higher. Secondly, the bulk of the tumor, what we go by with stage is the smaller the bulk is, the more likely of the success of the systemic therapies, because all the therapies we use have some toxicities, right? So the risk versus benefit ratio goes much better if you have a smaller bulk to deal with. And then we can choose appropriate therapies depending on the type of cancer.
I see. So it's definitely important to do that kind of screening to see what kind of treatment options may fit for these patients.
Absolutely.
And in terms of weighing whether a patient should undergo a lumpectomy as compared with a mastectomy, what are the factors that might make a patient more suitable for one option over the other?
So it's basically a lot of shared decision making. So the first issue is, can we save the breast? That we have to answer with some science and some ART-related assessment. So for example, the size of the tumor versus size of the breast is very important, because even with relatively larger tumors, we can use a lot of what we call oncoplastic techniques to make a cosmetically appropriate outcome, even though a large volume of breast was removed. So those are some technical things that we assess when we look at the patient. But then it comes the question of shared decision-making part, because generally speaking, there are obviously other factors that go into that decision, but generally speaking, when we save the breast, then we need to follow up with radiation therapy to the breast which was saved. Radiation therapy, again, generally speaking, is about 6 weeks because it's every working day. There are some short versions and stuff on case-by-case basis, but radiation therapy is a commitment on behalf of the patient and on behalf of the healthcare system. So because that's a part and parcel of saving the breast, that is on table to be worked into the decision-making piece. So in other words, there are patients who sometimes, even though the tumor was small, they choose not to save the breast because they live too far away and they cannot follow through with radiation. Or sometimes they're not willing to entertain the potential side effects of radiation, work-related, time-off-related. So there are lots of things that goes into that decision-making. Some people, cosmetic outcome is so important to them that no matter what, they want to do every possible thing to save their breast. And some people are too scared about the having to keep an eye with follow-up mammograms that they want both breasts gone. So you have to meet the patient where she is and entertain all the options to land on a decision that's feasible.
So it definitely comes down to patient preference in a lot of cases, right, from the sounds of it.
Right.
And so beyond that, what are some new treatment options that you have adopted in your clinic this year?
So, well, this year, I mean, I would say last few years, is some of the things is we understand the tumor biology much better, for example. So I do genomic profile with 150 gene tests of the tumor to figure out exactly what type of tumor it is. The reason that's very important is, regardless of what the tumor size is, based on this test, we can predict who would benefit from chemotherapy, who would not benefit from chemotherapy, and who would benefit from endocrine therapy or long-term endocrine therapy. When I know that upfront, then we can make a case of, let's say somebody would benefit from chemotherapy, then I err towards trying to use the chemotherapy first, because the more response I can get upfront, the surgical task becomes easier and easier. If the cancer is already at stage two, meaning that it has spread to the glands and the armpit, and I know that they need chemotherapy, giving them chemotherapy first might heal the armpit, and I may no longer need to do a big operation in the armpit. So that is one area of relative newness, not this year, but it's relatively new. The other important thing is that the more screening technologies are getting advanced in terms of quality of image, we're finding very tiny tumors, which is good news for the patient, a little bit difficult news for the surgeon, because now I got to find this tiny tumor and remove it. So when the tumor is very tiny, then we have to figure out the best possible way to find exactly where to go and get it. And so the time tested, you know, for many, many decades, we had been using a little flagpole kind of a wire. It's very thin wire that the patient will go to the imaging center. They'll put in a wire. The wire will stick out of the breast, and then the patient will be transported to the operating room and follow the wire and take the tumor out. You can see all the logistics issues associated with that kind of thing. So nowadays we have devices like the magnetic device. I prefer Moly, which is a little bitty seed that is implanted in the breast with imaging, but nothing is sticking out of the breast, which means it doesn't have to be the morning of surgery. It can be a few days before, doesn't bother the patient, doesn't bother anybody. When the patient comes to the operating room, I can use a detecting wand that will find the magnet and give me the distance exactly so I can plan my surgery and therefore try to do as cosmetically as possible the surgical approach. So that's the other new thing that we're doing. The third new thing that I've been doing for the last few years and have published on it is that there are some very low-risk cancers that do not require chemotherapy, and they do not require, many times if they're an elderly age group, they don't require radiation therapy either, that we know that we can just ablate the tumor while they're still in the breast. Having to remove the lump and giving a scar is not really needed. So I prefer cryoablation. There are other ablative techniques with pluses and minuses. I think the benefits are higher and risks are lower with cryoablation, which is basically a little needle, a little bit fatter than the biopsy needle, but you can skewer the tumor and freeze kill the tumor. It takes about 20 minutes and patient can go home. You can do it in your office. You minus the whole operating room part of it. So those are just some of the newer things that we are doing.
So definitely a lot of interesting developments and advancements in the field. And right. I do remember talking to you some months ago about the Moly procedure. So it seems like you're still getting a lot of use out of it, which is good to hear.
Right. It's been really interesting to me that, to be honest, I actually originally resisted the use of Moly because I used to do my own ultrasounds a lot, which I'd still use ultrasound, and it has its own value. But tumors that are very, very small, and sometimes the biopsy has created a little blood clot and you can no longer see them or it has healed. So Moly has been an excellent device. The way I compared it to some of the other devices that are similar to it that can be implanted in the breast, the reason I landed on the side of Moly were quite a few. First off, there is not a deactivation problem with something. Some of the devices can be deactivated with the operating room lights or some other instrumentation, or if you accidentally touch it with a cautery, then now you can no longer detect it. That's a huge risk. If the patient's asleep in the anesthesia, under anesthesia in the operating room, and for some reason or some complication, I no longer know where the tumor is, that's a huge deal. So that's one problem that we don't run into with Molly. The other thing is also that because of that ease, we don't have to change the regular running of the OR, change the instruments to some devices require plastic instruments because other magnetic things interfere with the fields steel instruments, things like that. So the logistic part of it is very smooth. If I have five cases and three are Molly and two are not Molly, I can go back to back to back with very smoothly, which is harder to do when you're using a device which you have to change the entire setting of the operating room. That takes time. And the most expensive thing in the operating room is time. So third, which is from a healthcare return on investment perspective, as a surgeon, I like the idea, but that's not a make or break for me. But from the healthcare return on investment perspective, I feel that we have noticed that Molly is also the most cost-effective approach. So you get the best bang for your buck out of that system. So based on all of these reasons, I'm a huge Molly fan, and that's not changing anytime soon.
Moving on, so I wanted to ask you or talk to you a little bit about the use of artificial intelligence, because this has been a notable trend that even with other doctors that I've spoken to in the past, it seems like it's becoming a more prominent tool in a lot of different disease types. So I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about the current use and potential future applications of AI in breast cancer?
It's a little bit loaded what I think about it, in the sense that in some ways, if you really see what artificial intelligence is, it's basically the ability to compute things with human brain we couldn't compute, right? I mean, that's what AI is. So ever since we had computers, actually a lot of things already have been using artificial intelligence when we do data mining and stuff, because the computer will mine that for us and will tell us, okay, this is good or this is bad. But it just has a new twist, because not that the artificial intelligence is new, but the way it's delivered, it's kind of new. So now people can have apps and programs and say this or that. So there are some misgivings I have about that too. But from a scientific perspective, if we stick to what was always artificial intelligence, in terms of being able to compute large swaths of data, which are beyond the capacity of just a human brain to do, then our learning gets that much farther up. So right now, for example, we're seeing some great work, which I think will majorly change the face of breast cancer, is that there are some companies that are looking at the entire human genome on the tumor cell. Now, without artificial intelligence and computational capabilities, you don't know which gene is culprit and what to attack and what to treat it with. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But now that not only from the tumor, but also just with a little blood test, because tumors shed their DNA and the entire cell is sometimes shed within the stream. And those tests, we were able to do those tests and find those genes, but we didn't know what to do with it. Now that all that data can be computed with the use of AI, we are able to narrow down, especially tumors that have been resistant, they're not responding to certain therapies or have come back three or four times. And you can draw these blood tests to figure out what changed in the tumor that taught it to learn resistance, what to attack to kill it. I think that's where it's going to be most helpful. The other area, which I'm not sure is going to change a whole lot, we heard about the use of AI in the screen detection part of the imaging side of AI, that there are lots of little pixels that can be fed into, and the work is being done right now where they're fed into and some algorithms, and it can compute for you what is more likely to be cancer than not. There is some positivity to it. I think the impact will be a little bit smaller. That's just my opinion. It's because we are already very good at detecting very, very tiny. So the room for improvement is not that much with all the technological development that has already been out there. However, it could help from a fiscal responsibility perspective. So for example, there could be an algorithm that might say, you know what, if you are in a certain group based on this image, maybe you're off the hook for a couple years. And so instead of doing every year testing, which is going to have some healthcare cost impact for that reason. So it's a little in infancy at this point. I don't know which direction it would go. I don't think the detection alone is a huge impact, but if we can do it in a most cost-effective way, that might be the impact that would be more fruitful in that arena.
Yeah, great breakdown. Thank you. Well, it'll be interesting to see like how this kind of technology evolves in the future and how it may help with the cost-effective side of treatment.
One of the things I'll caution, though, with all these things, I don't think that people should misunderstand the use of artificial intelligence to replace the good old-fashioned regular intelligence. And that's what my worry is, that talking to your patient, understanding where they're coming from, what their realities are, and making the best treatment plan, that's the human connection. And I have heard talks about, you know, there's pluses with telemed, don't get me wrong, and I'm all for it in certain angles. But some algorithms are being promoted to replace a doctor-patient relationship. I don't think that's ever going to be a good idea.
Yeah, and I would have to agree. I mean, regardless of whether we're talking about breast cancer treatment or any other industry, I think it's important that AI is used only as a tool rather than like to supplement the human aspect rather than to replace it entirely. Are you working on any research relevant to the breast cancer space that you would like to highlight?
Well, we talked about Molly. I've submitted our additional work with about first 30 cases. We were able to document that our operating time was much faster when we used Molly versus when we used wires. So we're going to work on that paper. I've submitted an abstract. We'll see where that goes. So that's the part of the clinical work I've been involved in. Cryoablation I talked to you about. We are trying to move that field forward. I am offering cryoablation to the low-risk cancer patients. But on the research side and some of the animal model work that I've done, we've shown that there is actually some immune response to cryoablation as well. And we feel that even some of the higher risk cancers could benefit from cryoablation in addition to the regular treatment that they get. And that's what I'm investigating right now. So we obviously, when you bring those questions to the human trials, there's lots of ethical concerns that we have to figure out to make sure that people still get the best possible treatment while you're answering your scientific questions. So that's the second area I'm working on. And the third area we are working on is actually leveraging this human genome profile of tumors that I talked to you about. We are looking at a couple of genes that we feel are less in used in clinical realm, but may have something to do with why cancer becomes a nasty cancer. So we're trying to figure that part out to see if that will materialize into some new targets and new drug development. So those are the three big areas that I'm working on right now.
And it sounds like you're definitely keeping busy there.
Yes. It's fun though. It's all fun.
Yep. But when you look at breast cancer more broadly, where do you think future research efforts must be focused in this space?
I think it would be a lot on the liquid biopsy and the tumor genomic tumor profiles would be really, really big deal. There may be a time when we may research surgeons out of work, actually, and which will be a good thing for the patients, because right now I already feel that in a lot of ways, the reason we remove stuff in a lot of ways is to be able to interrogate, not as a part of treatment. I mean, it is treatment. It's a little bit early for me to say that, but it's heading that way, that because we obtain tissue that can be interrogated for what really will treat them. So if we got to a point where we could find those answers with a blood test, there'll be less and less need of people like me. I think that's where it will end up.
What do you hope your colleagues sort of take away from this conversation?
Keeping up with stuff is very important. There are so many papers every month. There's no way. It used to be that there was generalist. We do, hernia one day and gallbladder the other day and cancer one day. Things have gotten very, very specialized because of the technological advancement. It is impossible to keep up with all that's going on. I feel that the takeaway, both for the patients and for providers, is to find your niche in the specialty and keep up with all the newer technologies, have that network, because when we try new things, every new thing is the nature of sciences, things are not going to be perfect. There are going to be good ideas and then you'll figure out something didn't go right. So that network is very important when few people are trying things, that we actually help each other out as to what did we troubleshoot, how did we address this, and keep meeting and talking to each other and keep pushing the envelope farther and farther. From the patient perspective, that's the same part that's important, so they can ask the right questions and they can push us into delivering better and better care that's more suitable for them. And in the middle of all of this, the elephant in the room becomes the access. Not every patient living in every rural county is going to have access to the latest and greatest and newest things. So we also need to be cognizant to focus on scalability of these technologies. So how can we not just develop stuff that's available in Manhattan, but make sure that with all the technological advancement of communication that has brought the world together that close, that also addresses the accessibility, that somebody in some rural county where four people live in one county can potentially have the access to same quality of care. So I think that would be the broad brush recommendation that I would have.
Those were all the questions that I had for you. Was there anything else that you wanted to comment on or bring up?
No, I think that's all. That's all I have to say. I think we need to keep increasing the advocacy towards screening for people. There's still a lot of misgivings in people's mind. They're scared of radiation, or I don't have time, and there are lots of reasons why people choose to not screen. Nothing made a bigger difference to mortality from breast cancer like screening did. So all these advancements are well and good and great, but if you could do one thing, make sure you get screened. And that would be my message to all women who can be advocates for their own families and friends and church buddies and what have you.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.